Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh, yes, and I am Carol Jurgensen Sheets. Hi there, I'm Carol the Coach, and I do the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I am so glad to have you with me tonight. You know, this is the show where we talk about the tough issues. It's almost always about sexual or love addiction and group, individual, family counseling. You know, what works best when treating someone with a sexual addiction? And we know all the supports, all the recovery management that goes into that, you know, whether it be 12-step groups or prayer or meditation or having a sponsor and talking daily with them. Oftentimes it's developing a fellowship. You know, I was talking with a man tonight, and he's really working hard on his recovery. But as you can imagine, holidays can be very stressful for anybody, let alone someone who has suffered with sexual addiction. When that occurs, oftentimes the addict wants to go in isolation and medicate with sex, whether it be exhibitionism or voyeurism or pornography or affairs or one-night stands or prostitution. You know, there are all sorts of ways to interrupt the need for intimacy by medicating with a sexual addiction. So this man was sharing with me tonight that he really felt the compulsion to act out, not on Thanksgiving night, but the next day when there was a sense of relief that the holidays were over. And he was really trying to figure out what he was going to do, and he had already been on the chat lines, and he'd already been listening to different people describe himself, and he was revving up his brain. And he knew that he was getting more and more and more worked up, and he thought to himself, what can I do to break this cycle? Because I know me, and when I feel these urges and compulsions this strong, I need to act out. And so he called somebody from the fellowship. In actuality, it was a man who had called him just a few weeks before. And he said, truly, it made the difference in him acting out and going through with his bottom line behaviors, which happened to be meeting prostitutes. He was getting ready to pay a female for sex. Now, it wasn't just the holidays that was bothering him. It was also the fact that he had broken up with a woman, and he felt rejected, and he felt isolated. He felt confused. I mean, I think these are all feelings that all of us have experienced sometime in our life. Unfortunately, with a sex addict, that devastation, that rejection, that pain is so tremendously hurtful that the addict will go to drugs, alcohol, sex, and start numbing it out. So he was able to share that this man that answered the phone and talked him literally down off the ledge, you know, basically said, hey, you know, this fellowship cares about you. We want you to be happy. We love you. You know, don't act out. You're going to hate yourself as a result. The self-loathing will continue. You'll create the cycle where you'll act out more and more and more. And it was. It made the difference in this man's life, and he felt better as a result. Now, interestingly enough, when I was talking to this guy, I said, hey, what was the number one thing this man said to you that reversed your obsessiveness to act out? And he said, you know, Carol, it was as simple as, we care about you. I care about you. He goes, that's all I really needed. I was feeling so rejected. I'm overly sensitive. This is a CEO of a company. This is somebody who really, from the outside looking in, wow, he looks like he has his life together. No one would ever know that he resorts to prostitution and transgendered relationships and compulsive masturbation and pornography. No one would ever know. So that made the difference. And that's one of the things I love about the 12-step program is that in that fellowship, not only do you find out that you're not alone, but you find out that there are people that care. And when people care, that can be a missing ingredient in a person's life. You know, especially when you can't even care for yourself because you hate yourself. You hate that you've acted out. So, I know the holidays were tough. And if you're listening to this show, I know that either you have or suspect you have a sexual addiction, or you love somebody that does and you're wanting more information. If you happen to be listening to Blog Talk, good for you. I am on every Monday night. If you didn't know it, you can download every show I've ever done for over a year and a half. And you can put it on your iPod, put it on your computer if you've got one. And you can self-educate, learn about the addiction, learn what resources are available to you. Because I always try, at least 3 out of 4 weeks a month, I try to have experts in the field of different diagnoses and treatment centers and treatment modalities. This is where you get to decide, hey, that sounds like something I want. I've had clients on talk about it. They're talking about their issues and what they need in their life so that you can relate and you can hear what it sounds like. I mean, I work with priests. I work with ministers. I work with policemen. I work with judges, politicians, postmen, you name it. Now, I just made it sound like it's totally male, and it isn't. There are plenty of women that are experiencing this disability. Women tend to be more relationship-oriented, so they oftentimes have more inherent support from the get-go. But I cannot highlight enough how important it is to have recovery tools available to you, which includes people. People, places, and things. Now, tonight, we are going to be talking to Charlene Benson, who is an expert on dissociative identity disorders. Now, that's known as DID. It used to be called multiple personality disorder. And she's going to be talking about how much of the population is impacted, what are the clinical criteria for DID, and what resources are available for this disorder. She's going to be talking about it because oftentimes people with sexual addictions experience trauma. And when people experience one trauma or repeated traumas, they oftentimes disassociate. They zone out. They put themselves somewhere else so they don't have to experience the abuse, the rape, the verbal attacks. And when that occurs, I mean literally, that disorder actually is protective. It becomes something that really allows the person to be protected. But as with any kind of coping mechanism, if it's not necessarily healthy, then what ends up happening, and you can imagine this, is that they begin to use it to extreme and they then lose a sense of reality. And wow, when that happens, then they can no longer tell reality from creation of fantasy or illusion. And that can be extremely tough because then they aren't able to figure out what it is that they really need to make their life different. And so she's going to be talking about how can people receive treatment for this so that they truly have an understanding of what they can do to get healthy. So we're real excited to have Charlene Benson coming in. And you know, as I indicated, sexual addiction usually starts with trauma. And so people with this addiction oftentimes do disassociate, sometimes to the point of creating multiple personalities. So we're going to find out why it's no longer called multiple personalities. And I just really feel like this is a subject that can be very difficult to understand. It is so psychiatric. So I'm looking forward to interviewing Charlene Benson. She really knows her stuff and is, you know, I actually had a case that I was very concerned about, and Charlene is part of my listserv, and she gave me a lot of feedback on what I could look for with this client and his two daughters, and it was so helpful that I said, hey, you are excellent at describing this kind of stuff, and my listening audience would love to hear more about it. And she's going to give you her website and let you know how you can get a hold of her if you, too, worry about the fact that, you know, you might be disassociating to actually protect yourself. So, Charlene Benson, welcome to the Sex Help with Carol the Coach Show. How are you tonight?
Thank you. I'm doing fine. Thanks.
Great. Well, you know, this is not an area that everybody knows much about, including clinicians. I mean, it really is a specialty area. And so I wondered, from your point of view, how would you describe to the normal layperson what dissociative identity disorder is?
Well, dissociative identity disorder is ability to disconnect from what's going on in the present moment and connecting to something else because of the fact that there's something that's so uncomfortable or disturbing that is intolerable for the person to deal with. And so to be able to deal with those feelings that are overwhelming or intolerable, the person disconnects from the reality, and then they either go to some fantasy or to some other activity or behavior to numb out or to receive some relief from that those overwhelming feelings.
Right. So initially, it really can be a coping strategy that one uses to kind of numb out from the experience, the painful experience. So when does it become a problem?
When it becomes a problem when it's no longer functioning or serving the person well. So in childhood, that's the best way the person has to be able to deal with or cope with whatever chaos is happening in their family, whatever trauma they're experiencing, whatever events that are taking place that they cannot deal with and there is no way out. So that dissociation provides them with a way out. Then as a person becomes an adult, that dissociating or disconnecting from stuff that's intolerable then can become a problem for the individual, because if they're, say their boss is yelling at them and they disconnect from that because that's uncomfortable, then they don't remember what the boss or another person said, and then they're having to fill in the gaps. Okay, what is it that took place? And so then that becomes dysfunctional for the person.
Got it. And so obviously as a clinician, we all may have had an isolated case of this, but this became a specialty of yours. So how did that occur? I mean, how did you get interested in studying about this?
I had the very first client that I had as an intern teamed with a psychologist who supervised me, and she specialized in dissociative disorders. This first client had already been diagnosed with a dissociative disorder with over 20 known alters, and that individual consented to several interviews with me so that I could learn more about dissociative identity disorder. And I had the profound privilege of interviewing that person for about 10 hours over a period of few weeks. And then I took a year-long course on dissociative identity disorder sponsored by ISSTD, which is the International Society for the Trauma and Dissociation. And in healing from my own issues, I discovered that a part of me had been blocked off from early adulthood as a result of a traumatic loss. And I was quite surprised at that because I had no knowledge of the split until I saw a picture of that person almost 30 years later. I also, with more research and study and understanding, discovered that there is dissociation with a family member who's experienced a great deal of medical trauma.
Okay, so then it was your intrigue at getting to understand and study somebody with this disorder, and you actually spent 10 hours gathering information about him or her?
That's correct. And they shared the story of their life, of what they had gone through, what they learned in treatment. They'd been in treatment for years, how long it had taken for them to actually be diagnosed as dissociative identity disorder. So, yeah, there was a lot of research that I did. And then also that year-long course on DID, I read multiple books and articles on the treatment of the disorder and just lots of different aspects. In addition, I read a number of books that were written by people who had the disorder to understand what it was like on the inside. And one of my first introduction ever to the disorder was the movie Sybil that took place in 1976, and then they redid the movie, I think it was like in 2007 or something. But there's several books out there by people who have the disorder or therapists who have treated an individual with dissociative identity disorder, and then that client either cooperated with the therapist or chose to write a book on their own sharing their story.
Well, and so then I understand that you became sensitized to the fact that there were some memories in your own history that had been blocked. And so it was almost as if you realized, hey, the normal average person can do this also.
That's exactly right. And dissociation, we all need to dissociate at a certain level in order to be able to get something done. We dissociate by blocking out destructive noises in the background. For instance, if a dog is barking or there's noise going on around and you're having to study, normal dissociation makes that possible. We all have to do that. On the extreme end of inability to dissociate are people who have severe attention deficit disorders where they're not able to block out stuff, so they're seeing everything and it's sensory overload. So that dissociation on a normal level, there's a normal range. But then when you get to more of the extreme end of being able of dissociating, then disorders show up such as bipolar or post-traumatic stress or dissociative disorder not otherwise specified, all the way to the extreme end of dissociative identity disorder.
Okay, so you had referenced earlier in your description of what you were going to be talking about tonight that this used to be called multiple personalities, but now they call it DID or dissociative identity disorder. Why the name change?
I think because with the multiple personality, it made it seem like it wasn't nearly as accurate of a description. What is really going on, the individual doesn't have multiple personalities. They actually have identities that have dissociated from one another. So, for instance, in a normal individual who does not suffer from the disorder, we experience anger. Sometimes we have rage, or we feel depressed, or we're extremely happy and giddy. And in a normal person, we're able to be aware of all of those states of being. When somebody ends up with a dissociative identity disorder, those certain states of being actually get manifested in what that person feels like is a different identity or different character. And so maybe the normal part of that person is unable to show anger because that just was not allowed in their family. And so another identity takes on the angry state.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. In the same way that sex addicts compartmentalize and they can have a nice, healthy family over here, and then they can have this dual identity over here and be have a compulsion for something and absolutely hate themselves for it, but still have different areas of their life that are very different, you're saying that same thing in some ways occurs with DID, that if they can't cope with the trauma, then if they morph into somebody else or zone out to the degree that they don't feel, see, and hear things, they're able to deal with the trauma.
That's exactly right. And in a sense, addictions are the vehicle that a person uses to dissociate. And it puts them into another state of being where if they're having an affair with somebody or if they're engaged in whatever sexual activity they're engaged in, that does allow them to pretend that their life is very different from reality.
And that would make sense too. Absolutely. Okay, so now how do you view people who have DID? I mean, clearly, when we saw the movie Sybil, it was scary to watch somebody turn into so many different personalities. You know, you almost felt like you lost control watching her, let alone how it must have felt to be her. And yet, obviously, some of the characters were protective, some of them were aggressive, some of them were angry. As you indicated earlier, if you can't get angry in your real life, but you are super, super angry, that can come out in a multiple personality. So how do you view people who have DID? Do you find them tremendously emotionally disturbed? Do you find them really strong?
I find that they are very intelligent, creative, and for the most part, very motivated to improve their life. I just absolutely love working with people with this disorder. I'm constantly learning from them and amazed at the trauma that they've survived, whether it's extreme neglect, abuse of all kinds or any kind. Even medical trauma can bring it with a child in an early age can bring on this disorder if the conditions are right and the person's mental state or mental capabilities are there for that to happen. I believe these people are very resilient and they have a lot to give. They tend to be very high achievers. And for all of us, I believe that our greatest strengths are born out of our greatest weaknesses. And that's definitely true for the population of dissociative identity disorder. Their ability to dissociate makes for great actors, emergency medical technicians, emergency workers of all kinds, like in the emergency rooms and hospitals, and lots of other professions that require a great amount of focus or the need to separate feeling to accomplish the task at hand. But by no means does a person have to have dissociative identity disorder to be in one of these professions. But those who have that disorder can truly become what they need to be in the moment to accomplish what needs to be done.
So again, would you describe those, give me those personality adjectives again. You said courageous and?
Courageous, intelligent, resilient, very creative.
Okay. Yeah, those are all qualities we would aspire to have and to be. So obviously these people are, although they've created some strategies, some possibly resiliency strategies, they have also, those strategies have kind of turned on them. It has created, it is difficult for people with the ID to know the difference between reality and fantasy, is it not?
For some, it is very difficult because to separate from the shame, they've pretended that that part doesn't exist, but yet it does. To separate from some of those overwhelming condemnation or other very, or maybe pain, a great deal of pain, if somebody has severe medical pain, you know, from a medical condition or for maybe out of abuse, things like that, in order to be able to cope, they learn how to separate that out. And there's a part that takes that, but then that part is still there, unprocessed in their head or in their body.
Okay, that makes sense. Absolutely. Now, what are the indicators for someone who may be experiencing disassociation?
Well, this information is taken from the Dissociative Experiences Scale,
mm-hmm.
and so these are some of the things that are from that. So suddenly realizing that your mind was elsewhere, well, where when you were talking to someone or doing something, or having a realization that you arrived at a place without remembering how you got there, maybe noticing that you have clothes on that you don't recall putting on, or finding things among your belongings that you don't remember purchasing. Sometimes someone comes up to you and says, I know you, or maybe even calls them by a different name and insists, we've met before, and the individual has no recollection of it. Now, all of these things, too, remember, can be elements of what, as normal people, without this disorder, we occasionally might experience some of this. So to the degree that it's more extreme, that's what can contribute to the dissociation. Sometimes not recognizing family or friends, people that you know well, being accused of lying when you don't think you have lied, or not recognizing yourself in the mirror at times. I've had people report that when they look in the mirror, they see a different face, or they don't recognize their own face at all, or even seeing an animal in the mirror when they're looking in the mirror, or feeling sometimes that others, things, or the world is not real, feeling detached from your own body, or remembering past events so vividly that it feels like they are being relived in the moment, being unclear or confused about whether their memory is real or dreamt, or sometimes occasionally finding familiar places to be strange or unfamiliar.
So you're just sharing here some indicators of problematic feelings, beliefs, behaviors that may say that somebody has a DID, has dissociative identity disorder. What are the actual criteria for diagnosing DID?
The criteria for diagnosing DID is usually a person's been in the mental health system for 7 years prior to an accurate diagnosis. And it's common because it's so hard for people to identify. Just like I listed those symptoms, some of those things occur in normal individuals that don't have the disorder. And often they also suffer from depression, anxiety, panic, obsessive or compulsive issues, drug or alcohol, or other addictions. And so the criteria themselves are having two or more distinct identities or personality states, each with their own relatively enduring pattern of perceiving, relating to, and thinking about the environment and self. At least two of these identities or personality states recurrently take control of the person's behavior. The person has an inability to recall important personal information that is too extensive to be explained by ordinary forgetfulness. And the fourth criteria is the disturbance is not due to the direct physiological effects of a substance such as blackouts or chaotic behavior during alcohol, being drunk, or having maybe partial seizures.
Right. Okay, so again, when you're treating people with sexual addiction, what similarities do you see in the criteria for DID and for somebody who's experienced real trauma and developed a sexual addiction?
Well, I think a lot of this can overlap, that I think at the base of all sexual addictions is some kind of trauma, whether it's being neglected or abused or even verbal abuse that's sustained over a long period of time, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, or physical abuse, any of those things, or even medical trauma. I think there's a number of people who have experienced dissociative issues because of medical trauma. Imagine an infant who's taken away from a parent and has to go through surgery for heart problems or just any number of medical procedures. This child does not understand why so much pain is being inflicted on them. They're being strapped down. They're absolutely powerless, and their parents aren't able to be there. And so those are the kinds of things that contribute towards, they're at the root of addictions.
Well, you know, and you just referenced something that people forget about, and that's trauma that occurs to kids before they can actually speak, you know, so that for them, having a traumatic experience and not being able to make sense of it or to talk about it can also really lead to this disorder.
Exactly.
That can be very, very difficult, yeah. And let's face it, sexual addiction oftentimes starts with sexual abuse. And so I can see that would create that need to somehow, some way, even without knowing what you're doing, self-soothe by going somewhere else. Maybe that's noticing your crib. Maybe that's looking at a teddy bear that's in the bed, whatever it is, you can also learn early on how to zone out and self-soothe by focusing elsewhere. Now, again, you said these people are, you know, anybody who has DID is resilient, intelligent, courageous. I mean, I don't think we thought about things like that when we were giving them multiple personality disorders, but somebody who's actually treated DID understands that oftentimes diagnoses that are not that flattering, you know, bipolar depression or borderline personality disorder, may have those disorders as a reaction to significant trauma and environment. So,
precisely.
Yeah, so you treat typically people with DID and post-traumatic stress, bipolar, and borderline personality disorder, and I bet you see courage and resiliency and intelligence in those type of people too.
Very much so. They've come through very difficult situations, and in their world, their response to what was going on brought on the disorders that they suffer. That, or else even there could be some generational stuff that got passed down to them in their genetics, that half of our DNA comes from our mother and the other half comes from our father. And so whatever stuff that they had gets imprinted on our DNA, and so we could suffer from that. I use a variety of techniques with dealing with these clients, using art therapy, sand tray work, role play, education, using empathy to just understand their situation, mindfulness and DBT skills, which is dialectical behavioral therapy. And then I developed a new approach called targeted negative belief replacement, pronounced timber but with an N because it's new. And this is a combination of elements that I learned from eye movement desensitization reprocessing, identifying multiple lies, fears, and negative beliefs that are embedded at the time that the trauma happens, and found out that there can be many of those connected to one trauma. And then I've been using emotional freedom technique, which is tapping at key points on our body to desensitize the disturbing aspects of the trauma.
So will you say a little bit about some of those strategies? Because for people that are just tuning in, I'm talking with Charlene Benson, who is talking about trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, DID, dissociative identity disorder, and she's talking about some techniques that she has developed as well as techniques that she has used with clients that suffer from these disorders. So, for instance, you said the disorder that you actually have created is what?
The treatment approach that I've created is called targeted negative belief replacement, TIMBER.
Okay, targeted. Okay, TIMBER.
Yeah. Targeted negative belief replacement.
And so tell me about that. What is that?
Well, it's a combination of a number of things. Emotional freedom technique is like the engine of this train. It's the vehicle that I use to desensitize, help people desensitize from the disturbing memories or feelings, or help them to elevate their mood if they're experiencing depression, helping them to get rid of the lies and the fears and the negative beliefs that they have embedded in their subconscious. Emotional freedom technique was developed by Gary Craig. He wants the whole world to know about it. You can locate it at www.emofree, which is emotional freedom, emofree.com. There's a free manual available. It shows you the points that you tap. It was such a paradigm shift for me to learn emotional freedom technique that it took me a year to really change the paradigm of healing that I believed how healing took place before I started using it on a regular basis with the clients that I have. And so from knowing about emotional freedom technique, then learning EMDR and a bunch of other
therapy approaches, I realized that these things could be combined to make a really powerful train that hauls the junk that we hold in our subconscious to the trash. The emotional freedom technique is like the engine, and the targeting the negative beliefs, the fears, and the lies is like the cars of the train.
Okay. And so give me an example of then, when you say targeting, what might you want to target?
So I start out with what's going on in their present-day life, whatever's disturbing them. So if they come in and they have relationship issues, is my wife or my spouse, I'm having real serious problems with them or my kids or whatever it is that they come in presenting with in the office. I go, okay, well, how much does that bother you? 0, it doesn't bother me at all. 10, it's about as intense as you can imagine. I gather a few feelings that go along with that. Often there's frustration or anger or feelings of powerlessness or something like that. So I just gather a few emotions, and then I ask them to get in touch with those feelings and identify other times in their lives in which those feelings were present, and usually memories will come up going back earlier, and I find the earliest memory, and then also have learned about 3 key areas that were even earlier than what they can consciously remember, but our body stores the trauma and our body remembers. And so when you're keyed in on those feelings, your body will say, yeah, I have that feeling in my stomach or in my chest or my throat or in my legs or wherever it is the body stores it. When it's connected to those feelings, there'll be some intensity, even connected with in utero.
Well, that
or generational
is, and that in some ways is partially EMDR, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, the key part of I learned that what they call the float back, what's going on today connecting to earlier things from EMDR. But then in working with clients, especially those who struggle with dissociation, found out that there could even be earlier events that could be connected to it. I have had clients who struggled with suicidality issues, and we had gone to the earliest memory, done a lot of work on that, and it just wasn't taking away that desire to end their lives. And in asking about in utero, they rated that a really high number. And they had no way of knowing why that was a high number. So we did work on the in utero stuff and to clear that out. And after going home and talking with their parents, some of my clients have found out that their parents were planning an abortion, and this child had imprinted on their DNA that desire to end their life.
Wow.
Which was fascinating.
Absolutely. Amazing. Okay, and so give us another technique that somebody might want to pursue in dealing with their DID.
Okay. Journaling is a great tool to use. Not everybody likes to journal, but for those who do, journaling is a great way to do it. And even using different colored pens for different parts. If they know that they have different parts, and sometimes some of my clients will say, yeah, I've written this stuff, and I noticed that I've got different my handwriting looks different when I'm writing about one thing versus writing about a different. So sometimes that will be helpful because so that the parts can have expression. Because part of what's going on is this person, you know, when we block off something, we have blocked off that part of self and blocked off that part's ability to express their reality. Another thing that they could do is share with their therapist what experiences they have, no matter how weird they may seem. And if the therapist is not supportive, then find one who is. There are therapists out there who do not believe that dissociative identity disorder exists. So if that's what you're experiencing, I've had clients come in saying, I am not dissociative because I've been to a psychologist and they've told me that I'm not dissociative.
And so I asked them to draw a picture of what their brain, how their brain works, and they could not have drawn a more classic DID picture of having multiple parts that were named and explaining what their function was.
You know,
another go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to just add some other things that people could do, is, and that's reading the stories of others who have been through similar things that you have, which may shed light on your own experience and help you to know that you are not alone in what you're going through. If you are experiencing some dissociation or you've lost time and you don't know what might have happened, this could be something that would be enlightening. Also, there are a number of dissociative identity disorder support groups out there that you could Google and find. You'd have to Google and look and see what's available to see what might work. And then finding
a therapist. Obviously, our listeners are all over the world, and so Googling is the best choice, A, to figure out who is in their own very specific area, and B, to kind of read up on support groups or therapists and to get an idea of what feels like a good fit. And I don't know about you, but I really do tell people that, you know, when it comes to going to a group, a support group, psychoeducational group, it really does take several meetings before you feel comfortable. The standard is go to 6 meetings before you make a decision. I don't know if people with DID would need to go to 6 before they knew if it was right for them. What do you think?
I don't know. I agree with you. I do not know how long it would take. Maybe for some it would be less, and maybe for others it would take more, depending on how safe they feel in the group. And again, finding groups that address the addictions that maybe they're struggling with might be another way to go. Going to some of the SA groups, sexual addiction groups, or alcoholism, or gambling, or whatever, because often addictions interact with each other. And so if a person is experiencing a lot of distress, they might be experiencing multiple addictions. And so finding various groups to help with that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that when one addiction is controlled and maybe someone is abstaining from that, another addiction increases. And so it is really important to be with specialists who have certifications and who can also make recommendations. Now, I'm talking with Charlene Benson, and Charlene, clearly, if people wanted to get a hold of you, your website is Benson, B-E-N-S-O-N, R-A-P-I-S-T, therapist.
Oh, it's
so it's
BensonTherapist.com. Yes.
And on your website, what will they find?
I'm still working on my website, so it's still pretty new. I don't have a lot up there, so it's just very general. I just have some information about my background and some of the qualifications that I have. So I'm in the process of working on it and adding a lot more information to it.
Got it. If they wanted to email you, they could email you at benson.therapist@gmail.com. If they have specific questions, need specific resources, would you be willing to help them with that?
I would be delighted. I want to help. I just have a heart to help people heal. And DID, I believe, can be healed. I believe that we can, a person can learn to be able to cope and to find a way for the alters to be able to cooperate with one another instead of sabotaging one another.
Mm-hmm. Now, last but not least, I am a psychotherapist of 33 years. I have my CSAT, my Certified Sexual Addictions Therapy training. And one of the things that I really believe in is coaching. I'm also a personal life coach. And I truly know that tips are so important to help people feel confident and empowered. So what life skills or tips and techniques do you believe might be helpful for our listeners to hear about before we end for tonight?
Well, as I mentioned before, journaling, using art therapy, finding a therapist who can help heal from the trauma, finding a certified sex addiction therapist or multiple addiction therapist, ITAP, International Institute for Trauma and Addictions Professionals, .com has resources, IITAP.com. Going to the websites to find more support groups. There are 12-step groups that are helpful, both secular and based connected to religion. So there are a variety of support groups available. I would highly recommend people getting connected that way. Reading books about DID, there's a number of resources. Just a couple books, Fractured Mind by Robert Oxnam is a story about a therapist who helped Robert Oxnam, who was a very successful man, former president of the Asia Society, had seen President of the United States on several occasions, a story of his journey of discovering that he'd had 11 parts of self. Switching Time by Richard Baer was about a woman who, he was the therapist and a patient who had 17 alters. Even recently, NFL Herschel Walker, a football player, Heisman Trophy winner, he wrote Breaking Free, My Life with Dissociative Identity Disorder. So, and there's also several books for clinicians on this topic, which can be found by Googling, and one of them is Dissociative Identity Disorder, Diagnosis, Clinical Features, and Treatment of Multiple Personality by Colin Ross. So there's a lot of resources out there that people can research and find to help with understanding and dealing with this.
Well, I absolutely agree. And again, you certainly have a lot of resources that you've just talked about between books and therapists and techniques and support groups. I can't thank you enough for sharing some insight into this disorder that can be debilitating but doesn't have to be. And again, I can't stress it enough that if you believe that you have DID or have had trauma that brings about some features where you're desensitized to things and you just feel like you're zoning out and maybe you've forgotten what you've done in that, you know, you're dressed in different clothes than when you thought you, what you changed into when you got up. These are all indicators that you really need to seek a specialist who has this kind of background. And you heard Charlene say she's more than happy to help. So, Charlene, thank you so much for your wisdom and your love for this kind of work, because it is a specialized niche and not everybody can do it. I mean, I'm sure you have met many a client who was with a therapist that didn't have a lot of information about it, therefore they poo-pooed it. So keep up the great work.
Thank you so much, Carol. This has been an honor and a privilege to be able to share this information with you. I want to encourage everybody to get the healing that they deserve.
Oh, I 100% agree. And if you're a partner of somebody who may suffer from this disorder, or if you know that they suffer, I'm sure there are some support groups for partners, are there not?
Definitely. And again, ITAP.com has some resources available, and they have partner groups that can help. And whether it's from looking at whatever the symptoms are or looking at what the disorder is or finding what the root causes are, finding a support group that would be able to help them walk through this. And any 12-step group has general stuff. I mean, I think all of us at some level struggle with trying to please other people or trying to control others. And so at some level, that's codependency. And so if we're not sure what we have, we could always go to a group that's on codependency.
That's right. And one of those codependency groups might be Al-Anon, or it may be obviously Codependence Anonymous. So good recommendation.
Exactly.
Charlene, thank you so much. Have a great night.
You too. Thank you, Carol.
Uh-huh.
And thank you to all of the listeners.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay, so for people that are wondering, again, how they can get a hold of Charlene, you can reach her at benson.therapist@gmail.com. That's benson.therapist@gmail.com. And her website, as she just indicated, is just really getting off the ground, but it is bensontherapist.com. All right, so next week we are going to be interviewing another expert, and I am very excited to be talking about topics that really do apply to sexual addiction on some level or to partners that love somebody with sexual addiction. We're going to be talking with Deborah Kaplan, who is going to be sharing with us the book that she's written. She's an EMDR specialist, and when I first contacted her, I said, hey, I want to find out more about EMDR. And she said, you know, I have written a book called For Love and Money, Exploring Sexual and Financial Exploitation in Relationships. And so I said, okay, let's get with that first. So she will be on next week. And I think, as I indicated, you can download every show by going to blogtalk.com, Sex Help with Carol the Coach, or you can go to iTunes and put in sexual addiction, and my show comes up, Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Subscribe for free. It'll give you all the old shows, and it will automatically download all the new ones. So as I end the show, I want to thank you again for being a part of it and want to tell you that, you know, there will only be one of you at all times, so I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself. And remember, Charlene said that when you're plagued with certain disorders, it really can provide you an opportunity to develop courage, resiliency, and your own sense of intelligence. And so it's up to each and every one of us to take our obstacles that we deal with in life, find the tools, techniques, strategies, and support people, and learn how to grow stronger from them. I'll see you next week at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach.